Great Country Q94. It's Coffee with Kyle with Prairie du Chien Police Chief Kyle Tinor. I think we are on a streak. Everything I know about you has been incorrect. You have friends.
4 weeks of friends.
4 weeks of friends. I didn't even know you had four friends.
Well, my other two friends, they didn't know the other four friends existed either. So,
Of course, you have brought in District Attorney Andrew Burdick. So, good morning.
Good morning.
And so I don't even know if we can classify these people you've brought in as friends, because one is helping you do your job, the other two are employees, and the other one was just another law enforcement.
Well, I mean, you are the one that has categorized them as friends. I would consider Andrew a friend. I would also consider my coworkers as friends. So
hey, there was, I didn't want to like misjudge. But like I said, we have Andrew with us this morning, and talk a little bit about yourself. I know we talked off air and we can kind of repeat some of that conversation, but, just kind of introduce yourself, where you're from, what brought you to Crawford County?
So, I guess I want to double down why, you know, the getting is good and say, I'm Andrew Burdick. I'm Kyle's friend. please tell,
you don't have to suck up
please
to
tell everyone that I'm friends with the chief of police. My name is Andrew Burdick. I'm the district attorney here in Crawford County. I'm originally from the Detroit area, Michigan.
Okay, very different area.
Very different area. So I was born in Southfield, mostly raised in Milford, if anybody knows where that is. I went to law school at UW-Madison.
Okay.
And I practiced right after law school. I went to the Lancaster Trial Division for the Public Defender's Office. I did that for about 3.5 years. Crawford was one of my counties, which is kind of how I started to practice and get familiar with this area. I've been in Southwest Wisconsin the entire time. And then I tried my hand at hanging a shingle and being a private bar attorney, doing criminal defense. I'm a better lawyer than a business person, which is a polite way of saying I didn't make any money and wasn't going to. Decided that
you didn't have your face plastered on every billboard in Wisconsin, or you know, TV commercials nonstop.
Fortunately,
looking at you, David Gruber.
Fortunately for the community, they didn't have to see my face on any billboards. nobody had to hear me indicate that it was a one call, that's all situation.
See, you got the pop culture reference there. You said off air.
Well,
you said off air that you didn't get pop culture references. You got the David Gruber one like that.
Well, that's not a pop culture reference. That's a can I respond to advertising prompts. That's
hey,
just
I like it. As somebody in the advertising agency.
Right now, he's sitting in his office saying, that's why I advertise. See how effective that was? This random person from Detroit knows who I am. I signed up for the La Crosse office as a prosecutor a couple years ago. So I was an assistant district attorney up there. I did mostly sensitive crimes as my caseload. And then when Luke Steiner became judge in place of Judge Ryder, I applied for this job. It was appointed about a year ago, and now I'm here talking to you.
And now you're here and working with Kyle.
Who's my friend?
Who's your friend? Kyle, you and I have talked a lot before. We've brushed on this topic a lot, that, you know, the paperwork that goes on behind the scenes and all of the reports that are filed and everything that is done is so that when the due process comes, your officers are prepared.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is the job of the police officer is to make Andrew's job as easy as it possibly can be. And we take that, you know, I take it personal as a police chief to make sure that we're delivering a product to his office that's prosecutable, that can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and that can hold people accountable for their actions, and that the victims in our community feel a sense of accountability for the person that victimized them. So, you know, that's important. There's not near as much paperwork as there once was because it's all digital now. Now when DA Burdick says, hey, I need this case file, we send him a link on evidence.com, and that's the case jacket, and that's typically how discovery is handled as well, as we send them links to a lot of digital evidence, a lot of digital reports, those types of things. So that has changed a lot over the years, but it's interesting the dynamic of how we're both interdependent on each other.
Well, and you and I have talked about this, and you know, for the general public listening, I think the thing, whenever you send out a press release, I guess we'll talk about that. You send out a press release, XYZ people were arrested on XYZ charges. and everybody comments, lock them up, lock them up. And there are certain people who maybe commit the same offense multiple times. And it's why, you know, the cops aren't doing their job. And, you know, why do these people keep getting let out? Which is where you two collide.
Yeah, and that is kind of where once it gets passed to me, that's where part of my job isn't just to review those reports, make charging decisions, but that's where I kind of get to ask some of those bigger questions of, good question, why?
why has this person been arrested four times for the same offense?
And that's where, you know, once the case isn't litigating it, is I don't just process cases. My life would be a lot easier if all I had to do was push paperwork and get us to a meaningful conclusion. It's to ask a lot of those, you know, what tool in the criminal justice system do we want to use? What is our legal response? For some people, they do just need to have a meaningful consequence to stop reoffending. We call that recidivism. Some people have underlying mental health issues, treatment issues, and depending on what category people fall into, every tool in the criminal justice system, from jail to probation to diversion to fine, community service, prison, etc., all has a purpose and will work for the right offender to reach what we ultimately all want, which is a safer community, because people are, if they come into the criminal justice system at all, not coming back. So that's where I have to ask a lot of those questions, and the more information I have, and this is why, you know, I'm happy to tell people, you know, my office's most important relationship is really with our cops, because they know and have their hands, you know, their thumb on the pulse, so to speak, with what's going on, and then having a lot of those bigger picture conversations. But then the other part of my job is understanding that I'm not just here to win cases. It really is about trying to do justice. So why do these people keep getting arrested and released? Well, it's because they are presumed innocent. Doesn't matter what the press release says. They're presumed innocent until I, using the evidence that chief's office or officers provide me, do that whole due process gambit, and they're proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, or they plead.
Exactly. And just because you get arrested one time for one offense doesn't mean you're going straight to prison. We've talked about that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And we also have talked ad nauseum that handcuffs are not the solution to most of our societal problems. I mean, that's just not the reality. So kind of going back a couple DAs, one of Tim Baxter's famous lines every time I had a jury trial with him was, our criminal justice system in America is not perfect by any means, but it's the best that probably exists in the world. And he's right. You know, these folks are innocent until proven guilty, and that's important. That's important for my cops to keep in mind. It's important for me as a chief of police when I'm doing press releases, is to make sure that, you know, these folks are innocent until proven guilty. However, we have to balance that with the public's right to know. And when people are calling me asking, hey, why were there two police cars on this traffic stop? There must have been a huge drug bust. And really, it was just two cops backing each other up. I don't do a press release on that, right? But when we do an execution of three search warrants and a close geographical proximity of each other, and the public wants to know what's going on, it's my obligation then to release that. But that's just the start, right? All of that stuff needs to be turned over to the DA's office, and then he, you know, does his process of, okay, what can I prove here? What are the applicable charges, and what is most likely to get some convictions in court? And he does his job. And, you know, Andrew's the third DA that I've worked with, and you know, they all have different perspectives of different things and nuances, and we have to adapt. And I think Andrew probably would agree that his office adapts to us as well, and what our concerns are and what we see in the community is the public safety concerns. We've talked on air before, you know, marijuana is not ruining families. It's not breaking up families. It's not causing, you know, these great disruptions in our community. Does that mean that I'm in favor of legalization of marijuana? Not necessarily, but methamphetamine is destroying families. And so, you know, when we come into a home and we see a 3-year-old, 5-year-old, and 7-year-old fending for themselves because mom or dad or both are, you know, chemically dependent on methamphetamine and can't or won't, or, you know, just are not able to care for those children, you know, that's something that the DA's office needs to know and take a part in. You know, I've been a part of trials with manufacturing of methamphetamine, distribution of methamphetamine, and it's always those children that you know, I'm an advocate for, and making sure that people are held responsible for those types of actions. And, you know, that is a larger picture. That's not a simple press release. Somebody's found with methamphetamine and should be prosecuted. There's a much larger, complex problem there that needs to be worked hand in hand in with our office, as well as many of the other governmental agencies in our community's offices.
Well, you talked big picture, and I know we've talked about this with a couple cases that have come out, and I would assume this is kind of where your role comes in too, is, you know, you say you arrest, you know, Jim Bob, pull him over, and he has a small amount of methamphetamine on him. This is what we talked about, I think, last week, that yes, you want to stop him from using it, but you're looking at where did that come from? Who's bringing that in? Which I would assume is also, you know, for you, Andrew, kind of, you're also looking at the bigger picture of like, okay, yeah, we can bring charges against this one person and go through a lot of work for this, or we can go big picture and let's find how the meth is coming in and let's go after that person. Let's cut the head off the snake. Is that a good analogy there? I don't know.
So there's a few different things that you kind of hit on to unpack, if you will. So in the Jim Bob gets a small amount of meth, there's a few different people involved in that. And then the question about what we do, if we're talking about, all right, our goal is to stop the methamphetamine epidemic, pandemic, however you want to, whatever endemic you want to put on it, then yeah, eventually, you know, taking away the bigger picture, the actual facilities, just like any other business, that is certainly part of it. But just like all economic relationships, if that's how you characterize it, it's one part supply, one part demand. Jim Bob in this scenario is the demand side. So that is one is sometimes cutting the head off the snake is, as you put it, a good way of doing things. And our officers do a lot of work on trying to unthread, you know, which jurisdiction it's coming from, how it's coming in. Is it being transported this way, that way? You know, what are the methods upon which people are communicating? Like, if I want to sell methamphetamine, how do I find out who wants methamphetamine? You know, once upon a time.
I laugh, but I mean, that's a question that the general public has a lot.
And now, you know, things are, the most interesting thing that I've seen in the past is with the number of social media applications, as you start seeing more and more warrants for weird things that people are using to peddle illegal, you know, activity. Chief, when did you start?
2023.
When did you start law enforcement?
Oh, I'm sorry. 2003. I'm way.
So yeah, I mean,
we've been doing this show longer than 2023.
Yeah. I'm adding a two there. So 2003 is when I started as a police officer.
So yeah, people weren't using, you know,
Snapchat.
Yeah. Then. WhatsApp.
No.
You know, so that's
they were calling over a phone line that maybe somebody else could hear on.
Right. Absolutely. And that was, and there's a whole lot of interesting cases about wiretapping and things like that, that is now almost feels antiquated, when we talk about what people are using. So that's one part of it. But then on the Jim Bob side in this particular situation, you know, why is he doing this? What are his needs? What can we do to get him? Because even if he is just, I like methamphetamine, I think it's fun, I think it's a great way to stay in shape. Well, Jim Bob, you can't do methamphetamine. So what can we do? Is it a, you know, what is our legal response for him? And that can range anything from, all right, well, at least you didn't do the methamphetamine and then drive. You are going to go somewhere to do the methamphetamine. OWI laws is a whole different need to protect the public. But then does Jim Bob need to just spend the night in jail? Does he need treatment? Does he need account? You know, what is his accountability piece?
Why? I guess that's looking at from a community perspective of what community resources can you have for those users and those who are dependent upon it? Because if you pull the demand by, you know, having community resources available, then the suppliers don't have anybody to sell it to.
Absolutely. And then, you know, a chief already hit on this. The other thing is, all right, so Jim Bob goes home to Jane Bob and their two children who are also some version of something named Bob. I can't think of it for the sake of our example. But, you know, but they're part of this, too. If they see dad and mom abusing methamphetamine, coping, using chemicals to cope, they're probably not living in their best happy life. They're observationally learning. They probably, especially in our smaller communities, have a reputation as, oh, we all know what the Bob family's into.
Yeah.
Which then creates stigma, which then creates issues. And then if I get the opportunity to stay here long enough, I'll be talking with, you know, Chief 10 years from now about their felony conviction. So in the same way that you can cut the head off the snake, i.e. the drug dealer, you can also, I guess...
stop it in its tracks?
Yes, you can also stop this intergenerational need to create broken homes, create issues that then creates drug-seeking behavior. So there's two different things that go into the supply and demand nexus in a drug kind of issue, and it's all part of it. So there are different tools to apply pressure to different parts of that system, and it all depends on where your focus is and keeping that open line of communication with not just police, but Health and Human Services, understanding what does our community map look like? What who is intervening for each part of the criminal justice system, or in some ways when it bleeds over into the public health system, is all part of, you know, it needs a community to solve these community problems. And we're just part of that. And, you know, keeping those lines open is bringing it all together and coordinating it, because it's not just as simple as, all right, Jim Bob, you're locked up and good luck to you.
Exactly. And that's what, oh, Kyle is holding up a finger. He has to interject.
I just, you might want to edit this when it's done, but do you want this to be a long version and we'll record a short version?
We could.
Let's just keep going, and we'll, this is a good conversation.
This is a really good conversation.
Yeah, let's do it.
Remember, that's at 1622.
Okay, sounds good.
Oh, sorry. I talked too much.
No, we're awesome. I'm well aware. This is good.
This is great. And you know, okay, so we're talking about the whole like community, because last week we very much touched on this and how, you know, drugs are not a victimless crime, specifically hard drugs, methamphetamine, fentanyl. It is truly a community issue. It's not a victimless crime. So, you know, you brought up the multi-generational, you know, stigma that goes along with it. And, you know, are you going to be prosecuting the son in 10 years because they grew up watching dad do methamphetamine as a way to cope? Mom did it. I guess that's just what I'm going to do to find that euphoric high. And from like an anthropological standpoint, how do you look and go, well, what is missing in this community that we can provide so that this stops?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that I've seen in my career is a treatment court and the introduction of treatment court. You know, there was a huge stigma when we initially started having conversations about the treatment court. And, again, from my standpoint, handcuffs not solving problems, we bang our head against the wall trying to figure out a solution to this, right? And if we are so ignorant to the idea of a possibility of these people receiving treatment and solving this problem through treatment, I think that's shameful on us. So I think we need to look outside the box and find those unique scenarios and situations that can stop this trend. And treatment court has been one of those things, one of those mechanisms. You know, I've had other people, other friends on this show from the public health side, where they're strapped with the resources that they have to tackle this problem as well. And so, you know, it really has to become this holistic approach between law enforcement, the DA's office, human services, public health, you know, the court system, the judge's office, even to get the judge on board to say, we're not getting the solutions that we're looking for. And the solutions we're looking for is that public safety piece where we don't have to worry about recidivism. We don't have to worry about this being a generational impact. You know, unfortunately, but fortunately, I've been in this job for, you know, 20 plus years, and I've seen the 18-year-olds now that I used to come into their homes when it was chaos, when they were 2, 3, and 4, crying in their bed at night because we were taking mom or dad to jail, right? And now I'm seeing those 18, 19, 20-year-olds and plus. And quite honestly, I've seen both sides. I've seen those folks that have been now contributing members to society have come up to me and said, you know, there was one point in time where I really disliked the police because I felt like you were, you know, causing issues for my family. And now I've taken a step back and I've realized those were the only nights that I slept well in my bed because the chaos had stopped because you intervened. And I've also arrested those second generation folks. And so, you know, there really is an environmental impact here. And again, from a law enforcement standpoint, when we introduce the treatment court and you know, half of my staff says, oh my gosh, this is never going to work. It's incumbent upon me as a chief of police to say, well, what we're doing now isn't working. And so we have to figure out a better solution to this problem, or a different solution to this problem.
And from a district attorney, you know, perspective, you're kind of, and you've been in, you know, different as a public defender, as a defense attorney, and now as a DA, you know, you've worked with people all across the spectrum in terms of the level of guilt, the crimes that they have committed. And I think one of the things that we talked about is, in the end, we're all human. Right. We all have a human right to a fair trial, regardless of whether, you know, you murdered and dismembered a woman and, you know, committed the most heinous crime to I blew a stop sign and, you know, a very small crime, you know, but we all still have the right to defend ourselves. And that's kind of where you come in, is you've seen so many different perspectives in your, you know, three different roles that I have a feeling you have just a wide knowledge, vast knowledge of, you know, why people, you know, the different, how am I trying to say this? Why people commit crimes or like, you know, what is truly something like this is what's going to help this person turn their life around.
Well, I hope I do. I certainly like to think so. But apart from, I'll have to come on more often, because not only have I been told I'm vastly knowledgeable, I'm Kyle's friend. We're just winning all over the place on this program. No, and it really is. And treatment court is a good example, but not just from a due process of, okay, we all agree this is this thing we want, but also is understanding that a lack of insight, whether it be to drug addiction, substance abuse, or mental health generally, we all know that person where it's like, goodness, they need help, but they won't see it. Mm-hmm. Well, those people also have those same robust due process rights, and that's a good thing that we all agree should exist. And this is the word Chief used, like this idea of holistic. So my toolbox, for better or for worse, is I got little hammers, and then I've got progressively bigger hammers, and then the sledgehammer. So it's kind of how do we have this conversation of, you know, convincing the person to, hey, I think you have this problem. And that becomes part of the, and it's nice to have that perspective of, if you're a defendant, I'm the prosecutor. I can't just communicate with you by, you know, that's its mm-hmm. own appropriate set of ethical things. But so what can I do to reach you? And that's where I've got different tools, sometimes charging, sometimes, you know, it's different alternatives to the justice system, whether they may be. But that's the other part, is once you, not everybody who has a situation that should be addressed in terms of treatment wants to do it. And that's where you have to use the threat, whether it be the threat of consequences, the actuality of consequences, you know, what are the other tools in the justice system, is that you want it to be set up so you always have the option to seek those, you know, various treatment, rehabilitative type issues. But if you don't, and you choose willfully to remain a public safety problem, then there will be those consequences. And trying to kind of set it up in a way of, how do I communicate? And then the other thing is, just as a caveat, even though I like to have that perspective, I don't always have the information necessary.
It's very true. I mean, there's instances where you think it's cut and dry, or, you know, there's a whole backstory that you may not know about. You know, one of the things we talked about, and Kyle rolled his eyes at me a lot, and probably called me names in his head, but there was a certain case this fall in which there was a very, very brutal kidnapping and sexual assault. It was an immigrant. Got the president to come to Prairie du Chien. And my response was, what has happened in that person's 26 years of life that like, they have escalated to that level of violence? Like, what have they seen in their life that makes them believe what they're doing is okay? And yes, that's probably when you bring out the sledgehammer. But, you know, looking at it, if you were a defense attorney, do you bring up, this is this is how this person got to where they are. Did they do what's right? Absolutely, they were wrong, but these are the circumstances that led to this.
So that case that you're referring to, you know, that my trial publicity obligations are different, and that case is ongoing. So
exactly, and you can't talk about it.
So yeah, so I'm going to keep, you know, that is very limited to, I have to tell you, he is presumed innocent.
Yes.
He will get his due process. And most importantly, you know, that case is ongoing, so I'm not going to comment any further there. So now that I've touched on that, to kind of answer your question in terms of looking at that particular part, there are three things that we are to consider at the time of sentencing, and I'll go through them quickly: the need to protect the public, the seriousness of the offense, and then the character and rehabilitative needs of the defendant. That is, the case was Galleon, and then it became codified by statute. So that's actually one third of what we're supposed to consider at when we think about mm-hmm. what is right.
Yeah.
The law commands us to look into exactly what you just described. And that's, you know, we call those mitigating factors as well.
Yes.
So it's like, okay, there's different types of defenses. There's, I didn't do it. And then there's, I did it, but. Maybe I had a good reason. Maybe I have a tragic backstory. Maybe I, you know, any number of things that could lead to the commission of a crime, that kind of what you're referring to there in just general way is something we look at. But I really don't know that. And this is going back to, I can't remember if it was right when we started or right before. You know, as the defense attorney, that's part of having a conversation with your client. That's why they have a very valuable role in our system as well. Not just from, all right, we got this thing called due process. You go give them hell, champ. No, I mean, like, it's actually really important
yes.
for me, the prosecutor, and then the judge eventually, to hear exactly what you just described. Because there's a huge difference between, you know, somebody who has any number of behavioral, psychological, upbringing, trauma-type factors, and I did that really terrible thing because I thought it would be fun, and that if I put it on my social media, people would think I was cool. You know, obviously that person gets a very different legal response
yes.
and much
yes.
is entitled to much less sympathy
yes.
When there are no mitigating or even worse, aggravating factors
yes.
that we do consider. But that's where it is really, you know, that privileged relationship between a defense attorney and their client is something that's really important for the rest of us to try to get it right.
Yeah.
I'll just jump in real quick, only because I've talked about my time in law enforcement and seeing kids grow up. And I can tell you that there's been three or four instances in my time as a police officer where I've come across juvenile defendants of, you know, different acts and thought to myself, gosh, if we don't intervene at some point in time and get this person some counseling and some services, we're going to continue to take this juvenile into custody. We're eventually going to end up arresting this person. And there's a really high likelihood that this person could seriously injure somebody someday.
Things are going to escalate.
Yeah. And I have seen that firsthand. I can think of just two or three occasions where I had dealt with an individual at 14, 15 years old, where I said they have zero remorse. They don't have any type of skill to make decisions, good or bad. They don't have a social support network to reinforce that decision-making process. And it's just kind of a blank emotion and that fear of they're really going to hurt somebody someday. And I could think of a couple right off the top of my head that are in prison for hurting people very, very badly. And so it's one of the things that we talked, I think, a few episodes ago about truancy. And it's one of those things that I've really gone back to is the importance of an education and the importance of attending school to have, not to get good grades, not to, you know, be the top of your class, but to have that structure in place of decision-making skills, the ability to go to class when you're told, the ability to do homework, the meal that you're provided, the hopefully positive, influential, you know, relationships that you build, hopefully the positive, influential relationships you build with teachers and people that you can look up to. And those things, I think, are vitally important in shaping our 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds, and even lower, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, into the person that they become at 18. And that reduces my job obligation, I believe, to my core, that education piece is important. And again, not because they know how to add 2 + 2, but because of that structure that's in place and that decision-making capability. And unfortunately, you know, I, again, have seen the examples of folks who don't have that capability, then go into an adult justice system and commit serious crimes against people, and we have victims now to, you know, to say sorry to, because, you know, the we are tasked with keeping our community safe. So, you know, it's just a broader conversation of what makes people do the things that they do. And I joke with the public every once in a while, because I gave up like 18 years ago trying to explain people's actions, because you just, sometimes you just can't, right? You can't. And really nothing surprises me. And that's kind of a trait of law enforcement. If you're related to a police officer, married to a police officer, they're your brother, sister, what have you.
We talked about this last week, that your average day is so vastly different than mine.
Like, my sister will call me and she'll be like, oh my God, I saw this, 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 this. And I'm like just completely emotionless. And she's like, this doesn't impress you in any way, shape, or form. I'm like, no, that's a Tuesday. Like, that, it's not that impressive.
Your Tuesdays are very different from mine.
But again,
it's kind of like doctors. If you ever talk to a doctor, if you know somebody that works in like healthcare, and you're like, oh, I got this cut and look how crazy it is, they're like, that is literally nothing to me.
But on the flip side, I'm also keenly aware of 5-year-olds in our community and what they call Tuesdays. And sometimes their Tuesdays, they should never have to go through, right? And so, you know, this is that broader picture of now when they get into the justice system, if they get into the justice system, that's important to kind of see the bigger picture of what's going on here.
We've had quite a long conversation. I mean, you did warn me before we started this that you could talk. I thought you were going to give Kyle a run for his money. Because I often joke, I just turn on the microphone and let Kyle talk. So, I mean, this turned into an extended edition that we did not mean it to.
Yeah.
But I like it. It was a really good conversation. So come back anytime.
Well, I definitely appreciate it. Yeah, I'll keep talking until you stop asking me questions or tell me that it's time for lunch. But I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank you. We were talking with Crawford County District Attorney Andrew Burdick, obviously Prairie du Chien Police Chief Kyle Tinor. It's our Dunkin' Donuts Coffee with Kyle Extended Edition.